Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah. You're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of
you
Browns.
You know why
fans.
It's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos. Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
It is 6:13 every Monday with Mike Dettelier is Rouse's Markets Football Monday. Shop and save at Rouse's, the official supermarket of the Saints. How you doing, Mike Dettelier?
Fine, Tommy. Thank you, brother.
Hey, let me ask you this, just to get this out of the way for my own edification. When Groupie got the penalty on him for missing the landing zone, I was trying to see, and I even rewound it to see where he actually kicked the ball. Where did it land?
I didn't see it either, I'll be honest with you. But I just by the reaction of the announcers, I knew he hadn't hit it.
So I guess
just by the way they kind of explained how things were, he hadn't hit it.
What did the rules say? That it has to land inbounds? Did he kick it out of bounds? Did he kick it short of landing?
See, not knowing the exact thing, Ian probably has a much better grasp of the rules part of it.
It doesn't matter. But ultimately, it doesn't matter.
Yeah,
it didn't
because
help, but
just it helped the Bills. Yeah. The critical penalty
didn't
though,
help the Saints. I mean,
yeah. No, the critical penalty was roughing the punter.
Yeah, but even that, Mike, that's an aggressive mistake, at least, right? I mean, I know
listen,
I had a coach used to say, at least it's better to make an aggressive mistake than a passive one. But
yeah, he thought he saw something there that he could block the kick, and I get it.
He
I
was
get
pretty
it.
Close.
You're trying to win at this stage, and that's why you play the game.
Mm-hmm.
You're playing it to win the game. That to me, when it came down to it, that was the one that really hurt. And you think about it throughout the game, this team only had 4 penalties.
Mm.
They were more focused.
Yep,
they were more zoned into what they had to do. But 3 of them on special teams, as you brought out about the way the kick went, then the roughing the punter. It was Buffalo.
And then they had another one. There wasn't a penalty, but Yottam had a chance to – is that how you say his name?
Yes.
Had a chance to down the ball at the 2-yard line and kind of lost it in the sun or whatever happened to it, I guess, and it bounced right by him. So they had – you know, we talked Monday, Mike, Friday rather, about Saints had a chance if they did everything right, but they didn't. They had – you got Werner drops. First of all, you got Olave with the bobble. You got Werner drops the interception. You got Olave throwing the interception, right? Then you got Olave.
Rattler missing Cooks.
Yeah, Olave.
In the end zone.
That. You got Olave. Yeah, because that they talked about the I want to talk to you about that because they talked about it being overturned. But the big thing was that he was wide open. That was a poorly thrown ball, right?
Correct. It was a poorly thrown pass on that one.
And he was wide open.
I give Spencer a lot of credit. I thought he played a good game.
He did.
And Tommy, maybe for the first time this year, are we seeing the identity of a Kellen Moore offense and their ability to run the football?
Let me tell you. Yeah, he had a good day yesterday. I wanted to get to that real quick. Let me give people the stats if they didn't see it or not. But you had Kendre Miller rushing for 65 yards. You had Alvin Kamara rushing for 70. You had on Spencer Rattler's 49, and Shaheed had 5 on a jet sweep, I guess. But it comes to 189-yard rushing. That's not bad. That's a good way to win a football game. Plus, Mike, when you look at the balance, you got 34 running plays and 28 passing plays.
I thought yesterday was that's what I wanted to see. I wanted to see him run the ball because we talked about this all week. Everybody else had success running the football against the Bills.
Mm-hmm.
The Bills' defense, I'm not sure I'd even put them in the middle of the pack in the NFL. That may keep them from extending. Now, one thing yesterday, you saw what 17 can do. He wasn't always great, but when he had to be great, he was great. he made the plays. That's what a great quarterback can do to overcome your team maybe not playing as well as you thought they could play. He would make just a handful of plays, and it got you over. We got used to it here because the Saints had one, too, that could do the exact same thing. You don't anymore. The Bills do. And their offense is built on running the football. It really is. And I thought yesterday the Saints' game plan offensively to kind of beat them up front, run the ball, really worked. Because you know what happened at the end of that game? You got away. You were down. Okay, now by 12 points, I got to throw the ball. Buffalo played exactly. You played into their hands because of the fact now they can play sick'em ball. They can Bosa, go after the quarterback. Russo, go after the quarterback. Esposito, go after the quarterback. That's what they want to do. But, man, they got hit in the mouth yesterday pretty good, and they didn't respond well to that extremely well. And you saw the Saints had success with it, being able to run the football. And when Buffalo got away from running the football, that's when the Saints put more pressure on Josh Allen. They got away from it, too, after a period of time, after the first quarter and into the second quarter. They got away from running the ball. So everybody has an identity to who you are as a football team. And all I know is Buffalo's offense is explosive. They got people that can score from a lot of different positions. But, okay, nobody likes – well, very few people like to hear because they want to throw the deep pass all the time, hit the big play. Well, if you don't have the running game, Tommy, you can't do that.
I don't want that. I don't want that at all. I want to see him run the football. I want to see him rush for 189 yards a game. That's what I want to see.
And same thing like with the Eagles. You know, and Drew made the comment, it's the most boring offense I've seen in the NFL. All I know is they're undefeated and it's working. Okay, it works. That's what they do best. They run the football, and they keep you on the field, and they wear you out. And for the Saints to stay in this game the way they did, they did it by running the football, and I think it's the first time in the Kellen Moore time frame you saw this football team's identity, and they got after people up front. They moved people off the line of scrimmage, and, hey, it worked. It might not be the big pass if you got, you know, fantasy football and Rashid Shaheed and everything else, but it wins for you. And eventually – It'll win for you.
One thing that drives me crazy, you're ahead of the change, right? You pick up 4 yards on first down, 4 yards on second down. So what do you do? Throw it deep. No. Why would you do that? Keep running until they stop it. That's the way I look at it, man. I
agree with you totally. And, you know, but that's not for the average fan today. That's not what they want to see.
Why do you play, Mike? You play to do what?
I play it to win it.
That's exactly right. You play to win the game. We'll take a break, pick it up. We come back, 621 Traffic Now, WWL. It is 625 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL. We got Mike Dettillier standing by every Monday with Mike Dettillier. Is Rouse's Market Football Monday. Shop and save at Rouse's, the official supermarket of the Saints. Mike, let me go to the listener line here. Somebody has a question for you. Let me read it verbatim here. It says... I have a few questions for Mike. Do you think we need to trade Olave?
Well, it would depend on what I got back in return.
I would say to whom and for what?
Yeah. Are you trading him at the apex of what you could get for him? And the answer is no. I don't know, okay, from another team's standpoint, what they would be willing to give up to get him. I'm not in that position to say. There were some rumors in the offseason about teams being interested. And listen, that happens all the time. A team will call up, what would you give up, you know, in exchange for Olave? And this is what we're willing to give up. And it apparently didn't meet to what the Saints wanted.
Then he says, do you think if Rattler can't throw an accurate ball on crossing routes, then why is he starting? Well, he can't catch it for him, but go ahead.
Yeah, The Olave catch, to me, it's a tough catch, but, man, come on. If you want to be paid as a number one receiver, you got to come down with that.
And he pulled one down later with his hands.
Yeah. Now, again, the Brandon Cooks one was a bad throw. Mm-hmm. Listen, you're not going to be perfect in this world. I hate to break it to everybody, but you're never going to be perfect. I would much rather the physical mistake than the mental one. And he messed that throw up. The reason why Rattler is starting today is the head coach feels as though he gives him the best chance to win. Now, eventually, I think we all know it, that baton's going to be handed to Tyler Shuck. That's going to happen. You didn't use that second-round pick not to play him. And he's a different style quarterback than what Rattler is. But I think the reason the coach is playing him is because of the fact he gives him, in his eyes, the best chance to win.
Somebody texted in and said, running every play is no better than passing every play. You need balance. You do, but of course, I would say you keep running until they stop it. And then they texted back and said, no, mix it up. Don't be predictable. Well,
okay.
You keep picking up 4 yards every down. You know, you keep matriculating the ball down the field, right?
Okay. When everybody else played Buffalo, you had success running it. So if you have success running it, what do you continue to do?
Why would you stop? Why would you, if it's working, why would you stop? That's what I don't understand.
Tommy, I wonder sometimes what people see and what they expect.
Because it's first down and you pick up 4 yards, and the second down you pick up 5 yards, it's third and one. So why you would throw it deep? I don't understand that.
I don't get that either. Yesterday, I'll be honest with you. Your offense didn't lose you the game.
No, absolutely not. But yeah, let me get to this text, too. Somebody texted in about Carl Granderson in defense. Why would they drop him into coverage? But the play I saw Carl Granderson on defense, he played pretty well.
Okay, in that play, and we've spoke about it during the week, no team plays with 13 personnel, which is three tight ends, more than the Bills do. And they try to catch you a couple times where you have your stand-up outside linebacker slash defensive end one-on-one with a tight end. Because if you're going to line up three tight ends, somebody along the line is going to have to cover him. Okay, and the Saints had done a pretty good job of shutting down the tight ends. And then, bang, what happens? Kincaid gets loose. And man, he beat him on that play out to the flat. Overall, they played that three tight end pass pretty well, but in that spot, and I'm sure he was in that spot a few times, he got beat on that play.
Well,
but
I saw one play
that's just
he
the defense
well.
That set up because of the fact that very few teams do a lot of that, Tommy. And very few teams throw the ball out of the three tight end sets or the 13 personnel.
So big
the
man
Bills do.
Big man, you're asking to play defensive back. I'll tell you that.
6:30. Yes, indeed.
We'll take a break, pick it up, and come back right now. Time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. Along with Mike Dettelier, every Monday with Mike Dettelier is Rouse's Market Football Monday. Shop and save at Rouse's, the official supermarket of the Saints. Mike, tell me some bright spots you saw yesterday.
Right off the bat, Jonas Sanker at safety.
33.
And watching him, when Julian Blackman went down to the labrum injury, I wondered because, you know, with a young guy and the way Virginia used him, you saw him a lot of times he was up front almost like another linebacker, defensive lineman. Then they'd play him deep. And, I mean, they used him all over the board. I thought his early pro football time, he was taking some bad angles to the football. It wasn't that he didn't know where he should be, but he took a bad angle. Yesterday, he was in the right place, right time. And they got something there with Jonas Sanker. I was impressed with him, the way he put himself in a position to make a play. The other guy on offense, Kendra Miller. Tommy, how many times we've talked about, okay, when is he finally going to get it? You see him running, great eye vision, his ability to get out of a tackle and get up the field, and he's got some explosiveness to him. So, man, those two guys stood out. Also, too, he didn't start, but I think he's going to see a lot more playing time. Quincy Riley at corner. You can tell he's got it, too. Now, He had one play similar to what I saw with Sanker before this game, in that he's in a spot, but he takes a wrong angle to the football. Receiver beats him, makes a catch. Quincy Riley, another draft choice guy I thought played well. To be honest with you, each and every week I could say this. You see the growth in Kelvin Banks, Jr., at that left tackle position. Yeah, he's going up against Nick Bosa, and he's by himself. You're on an island. You're not getting a lot of help up front. I like what I see with the development of Kelvin Banks.
Tell you who impressed me yesterday was Velus Jones ran pretty hard.
Velus is, man, he got some speed. Mm-hmm. I mean, you listen.
And maybe that's why he's running hard, because it's mass and velocity, yeah. Right? And force and all that stuff.
My thing about speed, never had a bad day in its life. And he got it. I'd like to see them maybe use him a little bit more offensively and get him involved. And maybe if it's a jet sweep or a quick receiver-type screen. Because he played wide receiver before they moved him to running back. So you can move him all over the board.
One of those little things like it looks like almost like same as a handoff, right? But it's a pass.
Yeah, because you got – one guy to beat, and then he can take off and get you downfield. But overall, yesterday, I thought what didn't look good was defensively, open field not making good tackles.
Yep.
I mean, you saw a lot of broken tackles by Bills runners and receivers, you know, once that initial contact was made. That they have to clean up. They've got to be able to get better in maybe, if you want to call it, kind of gang tackling. But that 101 tackle, that wasn't there for them yesterday in some spots where they had some opportunities.
And Deuce brought up during the broadcast that there are a lot of guys freelancing on defense. That's not good.
You see that, and, man, listen, not just not the Saints. Man, and watching some of the games yesterday, some of these guys, they kind of play in their own little game. Now, I know it's early in the season, but by now, you know your responsibility. But I think it's for some guys, and it's something that's hard to break. They play in their own game. And you got to understand, you just do your job. Do your responsibility. But not only with the Saints, I see it in other games too. Man, some of these defensive backs and linebackers, they should sort of plan, okay, I think I'm going to be here.
Streetball.
I think I'll be there. I'm guessing where the play's going to end up. You saw it yesterday at the end with the Rams game and the Colts. The corner thought that was going to be a really short pass. He bit on that initial move by Atwell. And then, man, Atwell up the field. Touchdown.
And the other thing, if you're not freelancing, you might be there to help the guy that is trying to bring the ball carry down by himself. You might be able to help while he's hanging on for help. You might be maybe in the right area if you're not freelancing.
But,
right?
Man, these first three or four games of the season, you see it. And you see it a lot, especially on defense. I think guys just taking a guess. And Tommy, it's the way they train today, the way they work today, and really not having a lot of time. Those first four games of the season, you're just trying to work out what you're going to do the rest of the way. But, man, Deuce is right. Man, you see it all over the NFL.
Freelancing. We'll take a break, pick it up. We come back, look ahead to the Giants. Talking to Mike Dettelier, 651, 9 till 7. Traffic now, WWL. All right, 6:58, couple of minutes left with Mike Dettelier, who will be second-guessing at the Silver Slipper Casino on the beach, Hancock County, Mississippi, with the Cajun Cannon, Bobby Hebert, this evening. Mike, as always, we appreciate you getting up early. Let's talk about the Giants coming into town. The Saints, first quarter of the season, I guess if we look at it that way, 0-4. Giants, 1-3, beating the Chargers yesterday. Maybe chance for the Saints to post a victory?
Yeah, I mean, they know great shakes. They made the quarterback change with Jackson Dart. You talk about a flip of the coin yesterday. The Chargers threw the football with Jim Harbaugh as coach, and this is the shocker, 41 times yesterday.
Crazy.
You know how many times they ran it? 13. That's how you get beat. And then if you look at the other side of the pancake with it, the Giants ran the ball 42 times. They threw it 21.
Yep.
They were trying to protect their young quarterback. Jackson Dart got a real live arm. In scouting him and watching him throughout the years at Ole Miss, he likes to set up a pass play and then take off running right up the middle. Very similar to Josh Allen. Every once in a while, Josh will fake that inside stuff and then he takes off outside. Dart runs right up the middle. The negative thing with the Giants looks as though Malik Nabers, the former star player with LSU, and he was a great player with the Giants last year, looks as though he has a torn ACL and he will miss the rest of the season.
You hate to see that. You know, we talked about maybe the Saints giving Spencer Rattler the start, and then if he falters, pulling him and putting in Shuck 0-4, but I don't think Rattler's done anything to lose his job. You?
I don't think he's done it yet. And so I think he starts against the Giants. But you got a couple games here, Giants-Patriots, where you match up pretty well. And if you're going to get some wins early on, okay, it's right here.
Thank you.
It's this stretch.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate it. We'll listen for you this afternoon. Sports Talk with Mike Dettelier, Bobby A. Bear, Silver Slipper. /7:14, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Gonna be clear today. Good news is September 29th, next 7 to 10 days for hurricane season. Quiet, so we'll take it. Jeff Palermo joins us now, WWL.com columnist, Louisiana Network News Director. Every Monday with Jeff Palermo is Rouse's Markets Football Monday. Shop and save at Rouse's, the official supermarket of LSU. How you doing, Jeff?
I'm doing well, Tommy. How about yourself?
You know, look, everybody's talking about Garrett Nussmeier. First of all, Garrett Nussmeier didn't give up. How many yards was it? 400-something what?
Well,
400. I thought I had it here. 480 yards Ole Miss had in total offense. The 84 plays. And the other thing is, Garrett Nussmeier can't explain to me how you can. I'm just going to get this out of the way first, okay? How you can consistently have three guys on the defensive line whipping five on the offensive line, because that's what happened all day long. Am I wrong?
Well, the reason why. LSU's defense gave up 480 yards and Ole Miss ran so many more plays as LSU's offense couldn't stay on the field.
True.
I mean, they were 2 of 12 on third down, and a lot of it is
true
because this LSU passing game that we thought was going to be pretty prolific, a guy who threw for 4,000 yards last season, doesn't look like the same guy that we saw a year ago. And whether it's an injury, whether it's something else, I don't know what else it could be, but he's not looking like the same guy. Now, it doesn't help that Ole Miss is not terrified at all of LSU's running game, so they rush three guys and they put eight guys in coverage, and that makes it very difficult on any quarterback. So you do need that balance. You do need that threat of a running game, but this is not the quarterback that I think a lot of us thought LSU was going to see this season. And it's once again very frustrating that it seems like you have one side of the football that's good. And I know the numbers for LSU defensively in the end don't look great, but again, they weren't getting much help from their offense. And they're on the field a ton. And it just they got wore down as the game went along. Now,
well, let me just say this: at the end of the game, I was saying Garrett Nussmeier Heisman. What are you talking about? But then I got to thinking, maybe we don't know what we don't know. Maybe he's playing hurt. I don't know. You never know that. So then I tried to look at it a different way and give him the benefit of the doubt. But you can't get past three consistently beating five on the offensive line, can you?
No. And this offensive line has been a sore subject, in particular the run game. For the most part, pass blocking LSU's offensive line, it was one of the best in the country last year and really up into this game. It's been one of the best. But why, since Brian Kelly has arrived in 2022, and 2022 and 2023 get covered up quite a bit because he had such a dynamic quarterback in Jaden Daniels who can run for a bunch of yards for you. But why this team has not been able to develop a consistent rushing attack in year 4 of the Brian Kelly era is just – it's perplexing. It doesn't this was kind of what you were anticipating that he would bring to LSU as a strong run game. You had, and I think we're all kind of maybe tired of reading off the stat, but four guys on that offensive line drafted last year, but yet you struggled to run the football when it mattered. Again, you had a 3rd-and-1 situation in this game against Ole Miss. You try to run it right up the middle, and your running back loses a yard. We saw that at key times last year, including in the season opener against USC, and you see it again in this Ole Miss game. And it's just how – and now, granted, you had a couple injuries here. You had a starter, a freshman at right tackle in Kerryus Kern. Paul Mbenga went down with an injury during the course of the game, so you were down to your starters, and I get that. And I think if it was just one of those games where LSU didn't run the ball, you would say, okay, injuries, this and that, and you can throw out a bunch of excuses. But we've been watching this now for especially when Jaden Daniels is out there, we've been watching it for a year and a half. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to buy the excuses of guys were hurting this and that. They just can't run the football, and it's very, very frustrating, and it cost them once again. They couldn't run the football last year against Ole Miss, and Garrett Nussmeier and Aaron Anderson bailed them out on a 4th-and-long to send that game into overtime. Kyron Lacy catches the touchdown pass in the end zone, bailed LSU out of that game, plus Ole Miss made a bunch of mistakes. This game, Ole Miss doesn't make any mistakes. LSU doesn't run the ball. Tommy, they only handed the ball off twice to a running back in the first half. Mm. You just can't win that way. Nope. You can't.
It's puzzling. I got to tell you, man, it's puzzling. It really is. It's maddening. It's beyond puzzling. It's maddening. So I don't know what happens with Nussmeier from this point, because if he's hurt, well, then we don't know what we don't know, right? And it's not fair to criticize him. Otherwise, I don't know what else could have gone wrong other than he's hurt. Do you?
Well, the ball just doesn't seem like it's coming out with the same kind of zip. The ball seemed like it was floating in that game against Ole Miss. It can't get the ball downfield.
And I think again, that affects his decision. If he's hurt and he can't throw it like he wants to, that's going to affect his decision-making process. That's going to go back to when he takes a snap, right?
Well, it certainly can. It certainly can. I mean, he did try to push it down the field a couple of times, and there just wasn't the confidence. And again, to the defense of Garrett Nussmeier on this, other teams don't have to worry about the run game. So they can play off the line of scrimmage. They can really make it difficult to cover up all the passing lanes and all that. So it does. So that's why you do see a lot of underneath stuff. But still, in the end, it just doesn't seem like he's zipping the ball. And, Brian Kelly said when this injury first became public, it'll probably take the bye week. Now, this is – and, again, when coaches start talking about injuries, I don't know if you can ever really believe them. So this isn't a criticism of Brian Kelly. They're all – it's all top-secret lies.
Well, why would you not have a top-secret lie, right? Why would you give your opponent information?
And the other thing, too, is, Brian Kelly is going to he's someone that's always – when somebody presents him with an issue, he always – kind of gives the positive side of it. He's a lot of times he does that. And he said, hey, once they get into the bye week, and this is the bye week, they can really let this injury heal. So he looked good against Southeastern Louisiana, but that was against Southeastern Louisiana. This was against Ole Miss on the road. And it just didn't look right. And then Garrett Nussmeier was asked after the game, how you feeling? And he just basically said, hey, I'm not here to talk about my health and this and that. So, and Brian Kelly said that he's healthy. He says what Brian Kelly said is Garrett Nussmeier's healthy, but Nussmeier's got to play better, and so does everybody else on the offense. So they got a week here to kind of figure things out. You have a South Carolina team is coming up next. They're not a really good team. It's a chance to get right. Trying to bounce back. The season's not over yet, so there's time here to regroup from this loss. but they got to figure something out with this run game, and maybe getting Kaden Durham back healthy, that would certainly help as well. But Durham hasn't had a great season so far to this point. But
And I don't think – you can answer this when we come back. I don't think it would have made a difference on Saturday. 7:23, yeah. Traffic now, WWL. 9:27, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Jeff Palermo. Jeff, we talked before the break about Kaden Durham. He would not have made a difference on Saturday.
Well, he is LSU's best running back. Whether that might have helped a little bit, maybe they would have been more committed to the running game. That's possible. They really need, Harlan Berry shows you a couple flashes here or there, but again, it's just a lot to ask a true freshman to make that jump. Caleb Jackson had a critical drop on a pass where it looked like he could have turned up field and at least picked up a first down. That was a really disappointing play. And then Juwan Johnson is, you're trying to, I know he's been working as a running back for a year, but for most of his life, he was a quarterback, and it takes a while. So they just don't have that guy to give the ball to that I think they feel confident that, hey, even if there's not that much of a hole here, this guy can get us 4 or 5 yards. And maybe that's part of the problem as well. So you don't want to necessarily pin it on the entire offensive line, but LSU just doesn't have that bell cow kind of a running back. And I think Kaden Durham is certainly a good running back, but we just, he had that great breakout game against South Carolina last year, and he had a couple of other nice runs a season ago, but just haven't seen enough consistency out of him to really feel like, hey, this is the guy you want to hand the ball off to 15, 20 times, and, he's going to rush for at least 80 yards. I don't know if you have that confidence in him right now to do that.
I'm looking at Garrett Nussmeier's numbers throughout the season, 248 against Clemson, total yards thrown, 237 against Louisiana Tech, 220 against Florida, and then 197 against Ole Miss. That's not a trend you like to see going that way.
No, and I believe I got it in my latest story up at WWL.com. He threw for 300 yards plus in 8 of 13 games last year. Mm. So that just gives you a sense of there is something different. And the wide receiving crew is supposed to be better this year. And now, again, you lose Aaron Anderson in the second half. That was big, not having him, and we got to get a more of an update on that injury, so that's a bit of a loss as well. But you were anticipating, Chris Hilton continues. I know he had one catch, but he has not had an impact at all this season. Barry Brown has been okay. Bauer Sharp has been good, but they're not. You're not seeing the production out of that group that you were anticipating as well. So it's. I know we came out in this interview here today, Tommy, really putting a lot of it on Garrett Nussmeier, but I'm sure there's a lot.
The only thing I would caution people is you don't know what you don't know, because if the guy's playing hurt, he might be sucking up doing the best he can. So before you start dogging him, let's wait and see how it plays out. Thank you, Jeff. Appreciate it. We'll take a break. Come back. We'll have Bank On It, financial insight you can count on with Jason Shield, COO of Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. Right now, time for WWL First News. 7:47, 13 till 8, time for Bank On It, financial insights you can count on with Jason Shields, Chief Operating Officer with Gulf Coast Bank and Trust Company. How you doing, Jason Shields?
Doing good, Tommy. How you doing this morning?
I am all right, sir. Let's talk about refinancing mortgages, because it's kind of hard to tell when's the right time to pull the trigger, isn't it?
It is pretty hard to tell. And so now that the Fed has kind of gotten into the phase of lowering interest rates, I get asked a lot lately, okay, this is great. So when should I refinance my mortgage? And I'll start with the disclaimer that it's somewhat complicated and it's obviously situationally dependent, but I'm going to try to give everybody a couple of key things to think about to super high level to just know whether or not you should even start considering it. And so just to recap the rates right now, our 30 years at about 6.3 and the 15 years at about 5.9. The adjustable rate mortgages, which I will come back to in a second, are at about 5.5 for a 5.1 adjuster. Now, so most people know what their mortgage rate is today. And so my general rule of thumb, you hear when you talk to most mortgage folks is refinancing starts to make sense at about a 1% drop. So if you have a 7.5% mortgage right now, you probably should be looking to see what kind of numbers you'd see if you were to do a refinance. Now, why the 1% drop, Tommy? Well, it's pretty simple, right? You usually have closing costs associated with a refinance. That could be anything from 2 to 6%, depending on the size of your loan. And even if someone has a lower closing cost mortgage product where they don't necessarily have all of the closing fees, you'll still have about that, right? The average mortgage in Louisiana is about $245,000. So just some quick back and napkin numbers for the listeners. And this is generally how I have this conversation with anyone. If you have a 7.5% interest rate with a $245,000 mortgage, if you drop 50 basis points, which is 0.5%, you'll save about $74 a month. Mm-hmm. Not a bad number, but when you consider what that'll cost to your break-even analysis, as I like to call it, how long does it take you? That $74 will save you money when? It takes about 8 years if you consider everything exactly the same. Now, if you change that to about a 1% decrease, you're talking about $147 a month, about a 4 to 6 year break-even analysis. So you can see, if you're going to stay in your house for a while, that's why they like to say that 1% drop tends to make a difference in your monthly payment and your break-even analysis. Now, all of these assume that you don't extend it out, right? What you don't want to do is, if you're 10 years into your mortgage, you don't want to cast it back out to 30 years, because then you get into a whole nother situation where the amount of interest that you're going to pay by adding 10 years back onto that mortgage will more than destroy any savings you had by going to a lower rate. So anyone looking to refinance, unless there's an absolute reason that you would need that cash out for some reason, which is okay, you should keep your amortization about the same as you have it now. Otherwise, you're just kind of burning the money, even though it looks good on paper that you have a lower rate. Now, if you have a bigger loan, Tommy, these savings, basically, if you have a $500,000 loan, those savings double. You break even a whole lot quicker. But I wanted to use the average example for the state on that.
All right.
So,
go ahead. I'm listening.
Go ahead, Tommy.
No, I'm listening.
Okay. Where's the mortgage rate come from, right? Because everyone, I got plenty of calls when the Fed dropped interest rates and said, yep, I want to see a 25-point drop on the mortgage rates. The reality is that the Federal Reserve does not dictate what the mortgage rates are. In general, and I've talked about this a lot, but I like to remind everyone, the 30-year mortgage rate is about 1% to 2% higher than what the 10-year Treasury is. 10-year Treasury is 4.15% today. That's how you get to about the 6.3% that you see today. Now, the 10-year is in general driven by what investors see the market doing, inflation, big one. And so historically, when you see inflation go down, you'll see a 10-year go down. Or when you see, there's a bunch of reasons. I like to use inflation as a simple one, and I'll use the 2014 example. In 2014, inflation went down from the 2s to the 1. And then what you saw there was the 10-year rate went from 3 to 2.2, and that's when mortgage rates started to have those three handles that we love so much at 3.9. And so you can see when inflation starts to dial back, investors will lower the rate on the 10-year, and that's when you'll start seeing this. We've talked about it before, Tommy. Inflation is in the high 2s right now. Mm-hmm. And so your historical outlook in general is where mortgage rates are, pending anything crazy happening, the market's kind of saying you're probably going to see it in these 6s. Now, that's actually the historical norm, Tommy. And I know we all don't want to think about that, because a lot of us got mortgages when it was in the 3s, and we're like, oh, well, this is what mortgage should be. You go back and you look at the historical, about 6, in that 6% range is generally where you're going to see mortgages. So another thing I want to touch on real quick is adjustable rate mortgages, ARMs, because you're starting to see an uptick in those, mostly because of the desirable rate, right? A 5.5% interest rate sounds really good today on a 30-year mortgage. For those who didn't live through the 2008 mortgage crisis, adjustable rate mortgages are an incredibly dangerous product. It doesn't mean that there's not a place for it. It just means you need to know what you're getting into. So I'll use the most popular, the 5-1. And what that means is you get that lower interest rate for 5 years, Tommy, and then at 5 years, your loan is going to reprice, and it's going to reprice whatever the market is. we're talking short term and we don't even know what mortgage rates are going to do. That's a pretty big gamble. Say that in 5 years, I think interest rates will go down, so I'm probably good. Now, one of the most common things people tell me about an adjustable rate mortgage, a 5-year adjustable rate, oh, I'll just refinance it in 5 years. Mm-hmm. And I will caution everyone of this. And I'm not saying that ARMs aren't a bad thing. I just say you need to understand your risk. If interest rates are really high in 5 years, you may not be able to refinance. Let's just say your mortgage gets into that 10% range. The payment's going to be nasty and you may not cash flow. Your other problem, people say, okay, I'll just sell the house. Well, if mortgage rates are in the 10% range, you're not selling that house, Tommy. So I kind of caution everyone, when they see that shiny adjustable rate mortgage rate out there, to definitely consider those risks and make sure they know what they're getting into, right? So a whole lot of information. I think primary takeaways that I would think everyone should know is, once you start talking about you have a 1% drop in what a mortgage rate could be versus what it is on your current mortgage, you should absolutely start talking to a mortgage lender. Just start looking at what kind of savings you could have. And then another thing, if you've been in your house for a while, perhaps you had a 30-year mortgage, you've been in it for 15 years, or you've been in it for 10 years, looking to refinance into a 15-year mortgage will absolutely show you some savings. You only have 15 years left anyway. Why not get that 5.4% interest rate that we're doing on a 15-year rate? So a couple options there as well, Tommy.
Thank you, Jason. Very valuable information. Jason Shields, Chief Operating Officer for Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. Bank on it. Financial insights you can count on. If you want to go back and re-listen to that about when to refinance, when not, download the Odyssey app. Use the Rewind feature, 7:55, 5 till 8. Traffic now, WWL. 8:16 on this Monday morning, September 29th, second to last day of September, second to last day of the quarter, and hurricane season's quiet, so we'll take it. District Attorney Jason Williams joins us now, District Attorney for the City of New Orleans. How you doing, Jason? I guess I should say
I'm doing great, Tommy. How are you?
I'm all right.
All morning.
I should say the parish of Orleans, not the city of New Orleans, although I don't. It's a distinction that probably doesn't need to be made. Let's talk about what you want to do with defendants opting for judge trials as opposed to jury trials. And does the Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, have anything to say about any of this?
Yeah, actually, Tommy, the state of Louisiana is out of step with most of the other states in the union. We're one of the few jurisdictions in the country that allows a defendant to unilaterally waive their right to a jury trial and instead request a judge trial without any input at all from prosecutors or victims or survivors, which means the prosecution, the victims of a crime currently have absolutely no say if a defendant wants to make a quick shift to a judge trial instead of a jury trial.
So the Constitution says you have a right to trial by jury of your peers. It would be different if you were trying to take that away, but you're not. You're just trying to say what?
I mean, we're just trying to say that we believe that a courtroom should be a fair place for a defendant as well as a fair place for victims and survivors as well. The Constitution gives you a right to a jury of your peers. Most of the time, you would expect, and history sort of speaks to, defendants wanting people who walk the same broken sidewalks in Orleans Parish as them deciding their fate rather than just one single person in a robe. But in Louisiana right now, you can say because of whatever, maybe a judge's ruling in an earlier hearing, or just because you believe this person is going to be sympathetic, or for whatever reason, you want a judge trial. And you should be able to make that request as a defendant, but the prosecution, the local prosecutor in whatever parish you're in, should have some say in that choice.
So what was the catalyst for this, Jason?
We were up in Baton Rouge talking to the Senate about judge trials in one section of court in Orleans Parish. And as we were discussing the jurisdictional history of those cases, it was obvious to the senators when I laid that out and they looked at the facts that the judge had either suppressed evidence that the police had collected in an earlier setting, or found no probable cause for the arrest that the detective made at an earlier setting, And at that setting, at that hearing, or soon thereafter, the defendant came back in and said, I'd rather have a judge trial in this case rather than a jury trial because of that decision that the judge had made. It could be a bond reduction, mm-hmm. But there's a pattern. And the easiest way to correct this sort of farm shopping, so to speak, was to put Louisiana in line with the rest of the country. All of the bounding states around Louisiana require the prosecutor to have some input. And this is just smart. We were out of step, and we need to get in step.
So when it comes to numbers and stats and all of that stuff, do defendants do a lot better with judges? Are there specific judges that they do better with in Orleans Parish?
You know, I think if you look at the numbers, there was a report recently, it looks like there are certain sections where defendants would rather have or have asked for a judge trial instead of a jury trial.
By sections, and that's so analogous. That's the same as judges, Jason, when you say sections?
Yes, okay. Yes. They're picking judges who run certain sections of court.
Gotcha.
For whatever reason they've come up with. You've got certain sections where there are very, very few judge trials. Now, a judge has a right to decide the case however they want to decide it. And this is not about taking away a judge's discretion, but this is about balancing the deck in terms of being able to say, wow, if my case gets allotted to one section versus another, that sort of means that defendants are getting sort of different treatment based upon the random allotment process if this loophole isn't fixed in the law.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. I want to talk about your staff because you yourself, as I understand it, are a pretty good litigator, but you can't try every case yourself. If you do, you get criticized for not being the district attorney and for being in court trying cases. So that means it has to fall upon your people, that your prosecutors. And I know we'll talk about the status of prosecutors. What kind of a situation are you in? Do you have a hard time getting them or not? But you also are quoted in this newspaper article as saying that one judge is jamming up your prosecutors in favor of the defense. We'll talk about defense. We'll talk about what that means when we come back. I'm talking football, Jason. Defense. Jason Williams, New Orleans District Attorney. Our guest, 821 Traffic Now, WWL. All right, 827, Tommy Tucker, WWO. Quickly back to Jason Williams, New Orleans District Attorney. Jason, you are a skilled litigator, but you can't try every case. If you do, you get criticized for being in a courtroom, not running the DA's office. Tell me about your staff, because as I understand it, I've done a little bit of research. The average starting salary is about $78,000 a year for a prosecutor?
It's actually less than that, Tommy.
Okay.
And you're really talking about people with a lot of student loans.
Yep.
Coming in and the cost of living going up, and you absolutely, it's not enough for the work that they do. Corey Tassin, Corbin Bates, two of my best litigators on my team. They just recently successfully tried the Terrell Morris case of the 911 operator or 911 leader, and they successfully tried that case, guilty as charged on all counts. These guys were in law school when I was campaigning to become DA. And they are two of my top litigators right now. Just to give you an idea of how green and young, and this is not just an Orleans Parish issue. Across the state, it's really hard to find seasoned litigators. People do this work for a period of time, but they don't always do it for their career because it's just too tough.
So once they get experience, they moved on. Let me run real quick before we run out of time. Judge Leon Roche, jamming up your prosecutors. So you got a guy that is very experienced, a judge, and I guess he's kind of like running roughshod over these people? Or how would you phrase that, Jason?
In one instance, my prosecutor said, Judge, can we have 20 minutes for the officer to get through traffic to get to court? And the judge said, no, we're going now, and forced them to move forward, knowing full well the officer was trying to get there. Knowing full well that my lawyers had contacted them, had set up the case, but he was jamming them up in court to move that case forward. And that's just one example.
So let me get to this real quick. Jason, I'm sorry, before we run out of time, I know your time is valuable.
Sure.
I see a quote here from Raphael going at you. 81% of judge trials last year included no witnesses. How Is that about the prosecution? Is that about the case or the reports that the police are giving you? Tell me about our lack of people willing to come forward. Tell me about 81% judge trials, no witnesses.
We're talking about 14, that's out of 14 cases. And in those 14 cases, out of thousands of cases, we had witnesses who testified at motion hearings who did not come back at trial, and they had heard a judge say, I don't believe this case.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
It's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah. You're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of
you
Browns.
You know why it's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos. Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Meets a probable cause standard, and I don't think the evidence, and I'm suppressing the evidence and telegraphing how he feels about that case.
So wait,
and
let me jump in for a second. So what you're what you're saying is it's hard enough to get people to come forward. I just want to make sure I understand this right. Once they do, then they hear from the judge, basically the judge telling them, well, you're not going to get anywhere with this witnessing anyway, so don't come back, pretty much?
That is a scenario out of 13 of those 14 cases that we're talking about.
Okay, and Jimmy Harris is going to carry this water for you in a legislative session?
Jimmy Harris understands why this law change is necessary. He's already had some good contact across the aisles. Republican Democrats seem to think that this is a smart, common-sense fix, and I pray that it will be successful.
Thank you, Jason. I'm sorry to cut you off. I was just trying to get the questions in before we ran out of time. That's all. I know you're busy.
I'm glad you did, Tommy. Somebody's got to keep us on track.
Thank you, sir. Yeah, and real quick, I do want to get to this about the judge with 20 minutes for a police officer. There have been problems with criminal court justice, judges, not really managing their docket very well and being late to hear, putting this off, et cetera, et cetera. So it's kind of disingenuous to not give an officer 20 minutes to fight traffic, right?
It is, especially if you give a defense attorney another day in another setting if they ask for it. We're just looking for fairness across the board. Just want a fair shot. Same thing I wanted as a defense attorney, I want as a prosecutor. You want a fair shot in court. Both sides deserve a fair trial. The reason we're there typically is because somebody got hurt.
As does the people whom you represent, as do the people. Thank you, Jason. 831 Traffic Now News, all that stuff with Ian Ozan, WWL First News. 8:47, 13 till 9. Quickly to Dan Gill, professor at the LSU Ag Center, host of The Garden Show. How you doing, Dan Gill?
Hey, I'm doing great this morning.
So let me tell you what I did. I cut some fence boards, and I made them like a little hinge so that I went along the fence, and I sprayed this just whatever it is that kills everything. So now I got this brown line along the fence, and it looks like Augusta, where they put the pine straw.
Uh-huh.
And I like that look. But somebody texted in and said, I'm about ready to burn down my entire backyard. I have a vine called Bush Killer that keeps overtaking everything like kudzu. I wonder if they're talking about that morning glory. Thoughts?
Actually, there is it's Caradia japonica. It's called Bush Killer Vine.
Oh, really?
Or Caradia. And it is very prevalent in the New Orleans area. One of the more difficult vines to get rid of. It's hard to get rid of it. Just with persistent effort over time, you can control it. Keep it from taking over, but you can never let your guard down. You always have to be very vigilant and attack it whenever you see it and wherever you see it. And that has to continue indefinitely.
How do you kill it?
You can spray it with the Kills All. You might have used some Kills All along your fence there. Mm-hmm. Kills All does a good job of killing it, although you can only use it on the vine. If the vine's growing on a shrub, you can't just spray the shrub and the vine because it'll kill the shrub as well as the vine. So in those circumstances, it makes it hard to control. But where you can just spray the vine itself And a lot of times, if it's just on a fence or something, you can do that. Use something like kills all or eraser. But again, there's nothing that takes it away. Once you kill it back, it'll return. You've got to keep it doing that over and over again to keep it under control. So you really just can't give up with that vine. You've got to stick with it.
Does that have the little purple flowers, or is that something else?
It does not. You're probably thinking of a morning glory. You know? Yeah. They're blooming right now, and they have a little trumpet-shaped lavender purple flower. But Caradia doesn't produce any noticeable flowers. It does bloom, but the flowers are not very noticeable.
Some of these things, and I don't know which one it is, but I swear to goodness, I wanted to put a camera on it and do a time-lapse thing, because I think you could watch it grow. You go out there one day on Tuesday evening, and it's on the ground, and then Wednesday morning, it's to the top of the fence pole. It grows pretty quickly. Doesn't it?
Well, yeah. You know, most plants have to put considerable effort in building up strong, stocky stems to hold themselves upright. A lot of effort goes into those stems to hold the plants upright. Vines don't have to do that. They use other things for support. So all that energy that would normally go into building a strong, stocky stem goes into growth. And vines are well known for growing faster than any other group of plants.
So could you, if you put a camera on this, theoretically watch them grow in a day?
If you fast forward,
yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah, you wouldn't
not
sit
an
there,
actual
but,
time, but oh,
I'm
yeah.
saying in 24 hours, you would notice a difference, would you not? Noticeable?
Oh, absolutely. There are vines that will grow inches a day, and that's definitely noticeable, definitely measurable. So, absolutely, yeah. If you measure a vine in the morning and measure again in the evening, there are some vines that grow so fast you can see a real definite increase in size.
I got in a wrestling match with one of these things one time, Dan. I don't want to bore you with the story, but it almost strangled me to death. It was like a back and forth kind of thing, like you'd see in a movie. My blueberry bush has gone from green to yellow spotted leaves. There are tiny spider webs on the branches. For Dan Gill, how do I treat it?
Well, you know, blueberries are semi-deciduous, and they do lose a lot of their foliage going into the fall and into the winter. So this late in the season, I'm not sure I'd be overly concerned. It has been quite dry. So think about how much rain you've got in your area. Blueberries are prone to drought stress when it gets dry. So make sure you're watering them deeply if your area is dry. That'd be your best bet.
All right, somebody texted in and said, my front yard's full of weeds with little white flowers and mushrooms, which that kind of makes me wonder, because mushrooms really are, I thought, grew when it rained a lot or not. Tell me, Dan, you're the guy.
Well, they may be irrigating their lawn. A lot of people are getting out the sprinklers and irrigating. And if they do that, they'll get mushrooms. Nothing we can do about mushrooms. They're just a natural part of lawns. There's nothing you do to control them. Collect them and dispose of them as they appear, and that's about all you can do with it. The other weed is Virginia buttonweed, and that is a terrible weed in our lawns. You can knock it back now using a herbicide like Celsius or MSM Turf. Celsius and MSM Turf do a good job. They can be applied now following label directions. But really, there's no reason to wait until almost October to start controlling these summer weeds. In the future, I would tell people, check your lawns in May, June, and July. You can use Celsius and MSM Turf all through the summer. And the longer you let the weeds grow, the more damage they do in the heart of the yard to control. So think about doing some of this control in June and July rather than September and October.
How do you get rid of torpedo grass in the garden? What type of spray? And I would ask, Dan, what is torpedo grass?
Torpedo grass is one of our worst weedy grasses. It spreads by a rhizome that runs underground, kind of like a torpedo running under the water, aiming at a boat. Well, this rhizome runs underground straight like that, so gives it the nickname torpedo grass. Hard to control in beds, like flower beds. There are selective grass killers, like over the top. That you can use. So go to a local nursery and get a selective grass killer, and then you can spray everything in the bed. It will selectively kill off the grass and leave behind the ornamental plants that are labeled tolerant. It doesn't wipe it out. It'll knock it back. It'll kill it back. But again, like with the K-radia vine, with torpedo grass, it's not a matter of eradication. It's a matter of diligent, persistent, and frequent effort providing control and keeping it from taking over. But you can never let your guard down. You've always got to stay on top of it.
Would you necessarily not want this in a lawn? Because it looks to me like St. Augustine or any other kind of grass. Am I missing something? I'm looking at the LSU Ag Center picture.
Yeah, you are. In that it does, in a mowed lawn, it does resemble the St. Augustine, but it grows faster and sticks up higher. Mm-hmm. So it's a more upright growing grass. St. Augustine is more of a running grass. Torpedo grass, although it runs underground, once it gets above ground, is more upright growing. So it becomes a nuisance because it makes you have to mow more often. And then it gets into your flower beds. I have a whole fact sheet on controlling torpedo grass, and people could get that by emailing me at van.gill@odyssey.com. Just request a torpedo grass control information. I can send that to them.
Dan, you know, I appreciate your time. Real quick, somebody wants to know what the best times of the year to cut rose bushes back.
Well, we're past the best time for this one. We used to cut them back in late August, early September. So it's really too late right now to do it at the ideal time. We'll cut them back again around late January, early February.
If I want to put flowers in, what should I be planting?
Look for cool season stuff like petunias and dianthus and the cochiana. A little bit too early yet for pansies and violas, but the nurseries have a lot of heat-tolerant cool season bedding plants, snapdragons. Plant those now. They'll give you color all fall, winter, and into next spring.
And can you put a bunch of those and just have like a wildflower look?
I could just jumble them all together. Yeah. It'll look wild, all right.
That'll be a no. Thank you, Dan. I'm a concrete kind of guy, you know me. Dan Gill, professor at the LSU Ag Center, host of The Garden Show, 855, 5 till 9, traffic now, WWL. All right, here we are, 909. See a story at NOLA.com. Today is National Coffee Day. Well, Hubig's is coming out with a Cafe au lait flavored pie for a limited time only. Do you like coffee with chicory or not? I hate to hurt anybody's feelings here, but I don't like chicory at all. I just like regular coffee. But anyway, look for that Hubig's pie. Thank you, Ian. Prashant Yadav joins us now, healthcare supply chain expert at the Council on Foreign Relations. Talk about President Trump and tariffs that you heard about in the news. Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm doing well, Tommy. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks for taking the time with us. So tell me, I guess, first off, what these tariffs mean, and then we'll go from there.
So first of all, I think there's a lack of clarity in terms of how they will be operationalized, because the way they were announced was for companies that are not building a plant for manufacturing in the United States. Those are the ones for branded and patented medicines that would be 100% tariffs. Now, which raises questions in terms of, does the announcement by a company that is building a new plant in the United States sufficient to say they would not be the purview of the tariffs? Or will the government verify whether they are building or not? So those are questions. Also, tariffs are usually on a product-by-product basis, not on a company basis. So those are operational details that are yet to be worked out. But assume the case that there are companies that are not building a plant and they come under this purview, then 100% tariff on that is something that will mean that payers, hospitals would have to pass them on to patients in some way or the other, because 100% tariff is large to an extent that it cannot be absorbed by the pharmaceutical company nor by the insurance company or the payer.
So what does that actually look like, for example, with 100% tariffs going into effect today, on October 1st? So what does that mean? Like, can you give me, Prashant, some type of medicines that would apply to, or are the medicines already here? Would it apply only to medicines that are imported after October 1st? Who keeps track of all of this?
Yeah, so not all of those details are currently clear, Tommy, but mm-hmm. It would apply to medicines which are branded or patented medicines.
Those are the same, Prashant? Branded and patented are the same?
There could be off-patent medicines which are branded, so that's where the lack of clarity comes from. But let's assume it's only on patented medicines. So these would be the more expensive medicines, which are largely prescription drugs. It would be items such as what we need for oncology, what we need for in-hospital care, what we need for certain chronic conditions. Those would be the kinds of medicines. But the reality is that many of them are made by companies who have announced that they will be manufacturing in the United States. But that doesn't mean they're going to be manufacturing every single medicine in the United States. They've announced that they will be manufacturing some. So now it then amounts to a CBP officer, a Customs and Border Police officer, trying to verify whether the particular product that's coming in is getting manufactured or not. The rules on country of origin in pharmaceutical manufacturing are very tricky. We've had in the past a case of Cetrus LLC, a company which was selling to the Department of Defense and claiming that it is manufactured in the U.S. That claim was first refuted in a court of law on grounds that actually all of the active ingredients going into the product were being manufactured in India. And then the court once again ruled later on that it was actually fine to be labeled as made in the United States. So there are issues about also country of origin in how you determine what would you call as a drug that's made in the United States, for the simple reason that lots of things go into making medicines and some may come from outside.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about the manufacturing process itself, because is it like a car where you get a piece from here, a piece from there, a little bit of this from here? Can the United States have all of the materials it needs to manufacture these patent medicines? So many questions, Prashant. Do they have to import them from other places? If they have to import them from other places, are those ingredients subject to tariffs as well, or do we know?
Yeah, so I think what is important here is that country of origin laws will have to be super clear and precise in the application of these tariffs. But the two main things that go into making, so when I think about manufacturing process, there is a formulation process step, which is where the medicine is being made into a tablet, a capsule, an oral suspension, whatever form that we eventually take it in. The ingredient that goes into it, which is called the active pharmaceutical ingredient, that's the core, the bulk drug. And alongside with that, other things are added, such as excipients, which are usually meant to keep the product stable, not allowing moisture to be absorbed. So what we see is that for a lot of generic medicines, the active pharmaceutical ingredients come from India or China. And the Section 232 investigation, which is about national security, which triggered the pharmaceutical tariff debate in the U.S., was actually based on the fact that we have a very high degree of concentration of active pharmaceutical ingredients that come from China or India. But that's not the case for patented medicines. Patented medicines are made either in the United States, including their active ingredients, or in some cases, they are manufactured in Ireland, EU, and Puerto Rico. So I think what your listeners have to keep in mind is that for high-end medicines, we have reasonably well-developed and diversified supply chains with a lot of production already happening in the United States, including for active ingredients. Some, yes, occurs in Europe, and maybe that's the part that a tariff will change. But to what degree, it's hard to say.
There's no doubt, or is there a doubt, as to who would wind up paying these tariffs ultimately?
I think it'll have to be a negotiation between the payer, which will be the insurance companies or employers in some cases, and the pharmaceutical company. And to what degree do pharmaceutical companies absorb the tariff and reduce the price to the payers will depend upon the power equation. In some cases, if there is a drug where there is only one company, there are no substitutes for that product, the company may say, we cannot absorb this tariff. Payers, you have to bear this higher cost. In other instances where a company has a substitute or the product has substitutes, the payer or the insurer or the employer who runs the insurance program might say, we are not going to absorb it entirely. Let's share it in some way. So that's how it will most likely pan out. But I think before that is a bigger question, whether or not the 100% tariff will actually come into effect for all companies, or how will it get determined which companies are under the purview and which companies are not, which products are under the purview, which products are not.
Because you could, and I'm no Prashant Yadav, but you could just buy a piece of land and say, put up a sign that says future site of Eli Lilly plant. And I mean, I guess technically that would be in compliance to avoid the tariff, and you could maybe not really have any plans to build a plant at all, right?
Yes, I think usually the announcements that come out from pharmaceutical companies are vetted by their legal teams and so on. So I think there might be a little bit more due process that they follow before making a public announcement that they are starting construction on a new site. But there's nothing that's legally binding to say in a few years from now, if they say, well, we've discontinued manufacturing site or we've discontinued the construction of the site, there's nothing legally binding on that. But at the same time, I think the bigger question that arises is if a company says it's manufacturing, and even if we can verify that, yes, they are setting up a new plant, are all of their products then outside this 100% tariff, or only those products which they are saying they will manufacture in a new plant they are setting up? And that's very hard to establish, because usually a single factory makes multiple products. So if I am, in that example that you gave, if I am setting up a new plant and I put up a few cranes and bought a piece of land, mm-hmm. and if I say to the government, okay, I'm going to manufacture 100 different products here, that's extremely hard to establish whether I will indeed manufacture the 100 products or I'll just make one or two.
Mm-hmm. Is this a broad policy targeted at a few companies or one or two companies or medicine specifically, or is this a broad policy targeted at a lot of different companies and medicines?
From what it seems like, it is targeted towards a lot of companies, but I think given that there has been a bilateral trade agreement between the EU and the US, this would essentially apply to companies that are based in the UK and companies that are based in Switzerland. So the likelihood is higher that those two countries would be the ones where if a company is based there and manufacturing there and is exporting to the United States. So it would then apply more to Swiss and British companies.
So were these medicines developed in the United States and then they took the manufacturing overseas, or were they developed overseas? And if that's the case, is it fair to ask them to manufacture it in the United States?
Yeah, so some combination, as is the case with many things. So many of the medicines were developed with monies from the United States. Their clinical trials, though, are conducted globally. Some of the companies are headquartered in Switzerland or in the UK. Examples would be Novartis and Roche are headquartered in Switzerland, and AstraZeneca is headquartered in the UK. Mm-hmm. So these companies may have developed in their laboratories that are in the US, but their headquarters are in a different country. So then it raises questions as to, are they bound to manufacture it in the country where they conducted the research, or where their headquarters are located, or where it is best suited for them from a tax optimization standpoint, which is another important consideration in pharmaceutical manufacturing, because companies choose locations for manufacturing where they can optimize their tax payments.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back and we'll talk about the development of a medicine from the supply chain standpoint, because it would seem to me if the taxpayers have their money involved in this, or if they're vested in this, well, then maybe they do have a right or some type of stake in it to say that it should be supplied here. But if not, if it was done in a foreign country, then what's the likelihood, if it's a patent medicine, that the same thing could be done here? And if it's was formulated in a different country and is manufactured there, then to put a tariff on it seems punitive to those that are the end users of the medication. But we'll talk about it when we come back. 9:21, Tommy Tucker back in a flash with Prashant Yadav, healthcare supply chain expert at the Council on Foreign Relations, talking about tariffs on prescription drugs here on WWL. All right, 9:27, talking to Prashant Yadav, healthcare supply chain expert at the Council on Foreign Relations. So if you can take me through the anatomy, if you will, of the development of a medication, I'm trying to figure out who's got a stake in this, right? So tell me about the United States government, its involvement with companies that are based outside of the country when it comes to development of patent medications, Prashant, if you can.
Yeah, so I think we have to start by accepting that the U.S. is the largest funder of development of medicine. Some of it is done by private monies that companies spend, but the part that is spent publicly comes from the National Institutes of Health, other research establishments, and other federal government funding programs for the development of a number of medicines. But that doesn't mean that the U.S. is the only funder. European country governments, Japan, and the companies that are based in Europe and Japan also bring their own capital. So it's a combination of money coming from different sources, with U.S. being the largest part of that money. After that, development is carried out by companies in doing clinical trials around the world with the different patient populations. A drug is approved by the U.S. FDA or its equivalent counterparts in other countries, and then the payers, which is the insurance companies and other payers, pay for purchasing that drug, right? So that's a system of how the money flow from development to paying for medicines happens. Now, manufacturing in all of this is a choice that companies make unilaterally as to where they want to locate. So I think it is fair to say that the U.S. expects more manufacturing to happen on U.S. soil, both from the standpoint of national security, but also from the standpoint of the money that the U.S. puts into the medicines. The question that comes up is tariff and this kind of a tariff the right instrument to incentivize that, or are there other ways of looking at it? And then the second thing that comes up is that if we expect every single medicine to be made on U.S. soil, then it gets to a race where countries such as other countries in Europe who fund a portion of development, in some cases they might have funded a larger portion of the pie for some medicine, their expectation would then become, we will want this to be manufactured on our soil. And that's not the way we can sustainably run the system. I think what we ought to be thinking about is what measures can bring more manufacturing of medicines, in particular the ones where we have a very high degree of dependence on India and China, onto U.S. production. Tariffs may be a part of that. There might have to be other incentives that the government puts out for them.
What about economies of scale when it comes to manufacturing? Is it practical to manufacture the same medicine in four different countries?
So for medicines which are very large volume selling items, so let's say amoxicillin, an anti-infective antibiotic that we take, or paracetamol or acetaminophen, these are made in extremely large volumes where it is feasible to split the production and have it in multiple locations. But if we are talking about a medicine that is used only in a few thousand patients, such as many of the cell and gene therapies, the latest cancer medicines, mm-hmm. it's not possible to split the production into multiple sites because of the economies of scale. It will increase the cost of production if we say we'll have to manufacture this in two or three plants.
When it comes to, you know, manufacturing here in the United States and how these medicines are put together, is this a labor-intensive thing? Are we talking about employing tons of people here? Because I'm trying to figure out what the incentive is. It sounds good to have manufacturing here, but if most of it's automated and you're employing a dozen people, I don't understand that part of it. Am I missing something?
Yeah, so you're exactly right. It's not a labor-intensive process. It's a capital-intensive process, and much of it depends upon the monies that have to go into building a plant. So while a plant is being built, yes, it does create many jobs because there is labor, construction, electrical equipment, plant commissioning, engineering, all of that has to go into building a plant. But once a plant is ready, the number of people that work in the plant is fairly limited.
So how did the manufacturing get to where it is that President Trump wants to bring it back? I guess that would be the question I have.
Yeah, so there are two things embedded in this. One is the manufacturing that is occurring in Europe, in particular, let's say in Ireland or Switzerland. And that is driven largely by tax incentives, right? So those are countries which provide special tax incentives for companies to locate their production there. As a result, they choose those locations for items where margins are high and they don't want to necessarily end up paying high taxes. The second are products which are made in India and China, and that's largely because they moved there at a time when both labor costs were much lower, and these are smaller, what we call a small molecule generic, so the very basic medicines. There, the amount of labor required is a little bit higher, and also the environmental standards required for making them, which means the discharge that comes out of the factories, the chimneys out of a factory into the air or the effluent discharge into the water stream, those are not as tightly regulated, and which is another reason why some of that manufacturing has moved to India and China. And those are two different kinds of manufacturing plants that we want to bring back to the United States, but we can't bring them back with the same instrument.
So if you bring them back and subject them to higher environmental standards, that means it's going to cost them more to produce, which means ultimately, again, we wind up paying more for the drugs, right?
Yeah, and especially for these generic drugs, because they are one, they're almost the bread and butter of modern medicine. We use quite a lot of them. Every infection that a child has uses amoxicillin. Now, if amoxicillin is manufactured largely in China and India, we bring it here, environmental standards are stricter. That would mean we would have to pay a higher price. That price will get passed on to the healthcare system in large numbers.
So what would make sense in terms of supply chain, in terms of national security, in terms of fairness? I guess that's a very subjective term. But what, in your opinion, Prashant, you study this for your life's work, what would make sense? Do tariffs make sense? Or would there, if you go to tax incentives, if you're going to do that, well, then you're kind of subsidizing the production. So while we're not paying for it, the taxpayers are paying for it while the patients aren't paying for it. Tell me what the big picture on this, how you see it.
Yeah, so first is we need to have a very well-defined critical list of medicines that are important for us from a national security standpoint, where we see a very high degree of concentration of production happening in India and China. And for those, we need to give companies the incentive in terms of taxes, but also grants from the government to say, or purchasing guarantees from the government to say, if you set up an amoxicillin manufacturing plant in the U.S., we will buy from you for the next 3 years, next 5 years, so some period of time like that.
But it would have to be longer than that, would it not, Prashant, for that kind of capital investment, more than 3 to 5 years or not?
Depends on what exact molecule, and we can work out the numbers. But in some cases, a 5-year volume guarantee would be sufficient for a company to say, I will. Right. That's one type. Then the second type is...
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Where we want to ensure that we continue to have the lead we have as the country that is farthest has an advanced technology for manufacturing. Those would be the kinds of medicines such as cell and gene therapy, advanced cancer therapy, where our objective should be to ensure that what has happened for basic generic medicines, the same cycle doesn't repeat, that manufacturing companies don't choose to go away from the U.S. And in that instance, tariffs or tariffs plus other instruments would suffice to keep the manufacturing within the U.S. That's where many of the new announcements that have come out from the companies are already saying hundreds of billions of dollars will be spent in building new plants for advanced therapy manufacturing in the U.S. So I think that's what we ought to look at. Instead of coupling all medicines in the same umbrella, we've got to nuance and separate them and say, here are our objectives, and what is the best instrument to meet our objectives? And tariffs will be definitely one of those, but not the only one.
Thank you, Prashant. I appreciate your time and your insights. Prashant Yadav, healthcare supply chain expert at the Council on Foreign Relations. We'll take a break. Come back. Talk to our friend Walter Dublin, associate professor of economics and finance at my alma mater, UNO, about pharmacy benefit managers, our old nemesis. Right now, time for traffic, WWL. 9:43, 17 till 10, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined now by our friend Walter Dublin, associate professor of economics and finance at my alma mater, UNO, I'm proud to say. How you doing, Dub?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
You got class today or not?
I have a class tonight, yes.
Tonight, okay. Let's talk about pharmacy benefit managers and what's going on with the legislature and what's likely to happen.
Yeah, unfortunately, this is a tough one, Tommy. Well, PBMs, or pharmacy benefit managers, are the middlemen between the health plans, the insurance companies, Blue Cross, United, and the manufacturers of drugs, and the pharmacies. And so the PBMs, the manufacturers, negotiate with the pharmacies for a certain price. The PBMs negotiate with the health plans for what price that the health plans are going to pay, and they negotiate with the pharmacies for how much they're going to get paid. So they're in the middle of the whole, pretty much every drug deal, and you know, they have a lot of power, and they're also completely, you know, hidden. Nobody knows what they do. Nobody what prices they charge. None of the people involved know what anybody else is doing. All they know is their own negotiations with the PBM. That does create the possibility, and the particular deal that the governor and the legislature were looking at was that one of the three big pharmacies, there's really three PBMs that control 80% of the market, is also the company that owns CVS pharmacies. And so their concern is, with this pharmacy benefit manager somehow steer all of its customers from the insurance companies to CVS, because they make money if you buy it from CVS instead of buying it from Walgreens. So that kind of market share was one of the main issues that came up. There are several others, but that's kind of the one that's got the most attention.
So what is the state doing? The state's trying to take a contract away from CVS or something? Is that what's going on?
Well, they're simply saying that a PBM should not be owning pharmacies, which, again, you know, there's three big PBMs out there, and CVS is the only one that owns pharmacies. The other ones have other problems in that they, for instance, all three of them are connected to some health plan. CVS also runs an insurance plan through Aetna, and then United Healthcare has a different CVS, and Cigna has a different CVS. So a lot of the insurance companies own interest in a PBM, or vice versa. And so they're connected. It's called vertical integration, where the insurance companies that pay for it, the PBMs and the pharmacies are all kind of connected together.
I was in Texas recently, and I thought I saw a CVS clinic in a store, when that really got my attention, because that got me to thinking, well, wait a minute now, it's a pharmacy, it's the clinic, it's a pharmacy benefit manager. Talk about vertical integration. It's sounding like, and I'm a communications major from UNO, sound like the old thing with the movie companies owned the theaters, owned everything else.
Right. And so, yes, in fact, you have CVS and several other Walgreens that I go to does have its own little clinic where they give vaccinations and things of that sort. That's obviously in competition with the urgent cares and the primary care doctors. But again, yeah, they you go in there, they prescribe you the vaccine, and they sell it to you, then they give it to you and charge you for giving it to you.
So is there a doctor?
That's not related to the PBM.
No, I understand that. I get that. But it got my attention when I saw it, and it didn't say, you know, come and get your vaccination. It said clinic. So I presume they had either a physician or a physician's assistant there or something, one of these nurse practitioners or something?
A nurse practitioner, most likely. What they usually have there.
So when it comes to the Dub, we're having a little bit of a problem here. We got a little technical issue. I'm going to put you on hold for a second. Tim's going to talk to you, and we'll try to straighten it out to see what's going on, because I want to hear what you have to say, and I think it's important. It is not too late to win tickets to the next Saints game when the Black and Gold take on the New York Giants in the Caesars Superdome on October 5th. That's coming up this Sunday. You can score two premium tickets to the game, plus a pair of VIP tailgate passes from Bullseye Event Group, open bar, premium liquor, all-you-can-eat buffet from celebrity chef Aaron May, all overlooking Champion Square. Winning's easy. Go to WWL.com/contest. Enter one time every day for your chance to win Saints-Giants tickets from Saints Radio WWL. You can do it today, tomorrow, Wednesday, and Thursday. So good luck. Let's hope you win that. Back with Dub Lane, a professor of economics and finance at UNO. He's our go-to guy when it comes to pharmacy benefit managers. So, you know, CVS went on a massive lobbying campaign when this happened at the end of the session last year. It didn't pass because people, I don't know if they understood what they were talking about or not, but what is the landscape likely to look like after this legislative session? Dub, can they do anything about it?
Well, again, I mean, what CVS really did, they said, well, we'll just close all of our pharmacies. Well, obviously, CVS is the biggest pharmacy in the state, so that made a lot of people unhappy. I don't know that they would close their pharmacies, to be honest with you. But, again, we're just one little state, and so CVS is not good. CVS would rather fight, you know, our state legislature instead of closing their pharmacies all across the country or selling their interest in the pharmacies they've got. So, you know, this is a case where I don't know that Louisiana is going to win this one. This probably, if we're going to do anything here, this probably needs to be federal legislation.
And we're not likely to see that, are we?
No, because it's very, very hard to say because, I mean, I don't know what political power the PBMs have. I'm sure that they make a lot of money. I was looking into this a little bit more and was thinking of some things that, you know, the problem is, one of the problems with them is they have several ways of making money. And that they can charge the pharmacy one price. I mean, they may get the price from the physician, from the manufacturer, and then they charge one price to the insurance company and one price to the patient at the pharmacy, and they can kind of keep the spread in between those. And nobody knows what that is. And that can be different from different things. They also have this problem. They can, because they get the percentage they keep is a percentage of the price of the drug, they can force, you know, generics into a higher tier where the patient has to pay more for them, even though the generics are cheaper, because they want them to buy the name brand drugs that have the higher price, because PBMs make more money off the name brand drug. So there's a lot of things that are very suspicious about the way they operate, and you know policy change that I saw that made the most sense is to make PBMs do one thing, charge a price to use their services, you know, for the health insurances, because the health insurance companies need PBMs. They can't negotiate with 100 different pharmacies. Mm-hmm. I mean, 100 different pharmaceutical manufacturers, and the PBMs do that for them, and you know, negotiating with the pharmacy. So the PBMs play a role, but they just have too much possibilities of doing things that raise the prices either to the insurance company, which gets passed along the premiums, or to the patient at the pharmacy. And the other, you know, the big group is they tend to be squeezing out the small family-owned pharmacies.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that, too. I was at church yesterday and noticed on the back of the bulletin a mom-and-pop pharmacy that was operating. I don't know how, in this day and age, anybody would either want to get into a mom-and-pop pharmacy or that is sustainable. Thoughts?
Well, again, there's some, obviously some locally where that seems to affect a lot is in smaller towns where Walgreens doesn't want to open up a pharmacy there. And then the little family pharmacy is the only thing they have. Mm-hmm. And they have no bargaining power. And so they really have the squeeze put on them. Yes.
When it comes to, I don't know, this whole healthcare debate, and is this anything that's on the attention of the federal government at all?
There's been there's talk going on. I mean, there's a lot of interest that right now in this, and I haven't seen there's a couple of legislations. Ron Wyden's got some stuff out there, and so does Bernie Sanders. There's a couple of people out there that are raising some issues at the federal level. And I think that's what we really need to have is that, like a little state like us, we're not going to get anything. I can pretty much guarantee you that.
So if I'm on a train and I'm looking out the window and I'm trying to figure how we got here, pharmacy benefit managers originally were to negotiate the price down. Then they realized the money that they were saving and they kept it for themselves. Am I accurate there?
No, they just build a hole. I mean, like in almost anything you buy has wholesalers, right? Mm-hmm. Manufacturers don't often sell directly to the retailers. So in almost every type of manufacturing, there are wholesalers that buy from the manufacturers and then negotiate and ship it to the retailers. This is really a type of wholesaler.
So
what makes it different than in just a traditional one is that it's not just the manufacturer and the retail outlets involved, which is in this case the manufacturer and the pharmacy. We have a third party, which is the one that's paying for it, is the health insurance.
So,
and I can tell you, I know I have friends in the health insurance industry. They really hate the PBMs.
But
I feel like that there's a problem there.
But you told me that the health benefit managers came about because the insurance companies couldn't negotiate with all the different drug companies, right? But yeah. CVS created their own PBM, in essence, to negotiate their own prices?
Yeah, I think what happened, I mean, the PBMs existed because the pharmacies can't negotiate with the drug dealers.
Pharmacies, so that's what I meant,
yeah. We really needed the PBM. What happened is that CVS has acquired one of the three big PBMs. They used to be independent. And over time, they've affiliated with the insurance companies like United, Cigna, and with pharmacies like CVS. At one point, they were independent, three independent PBMs. The integration happened by acquiring the big, you know, the insurance companies acquiring them, or them acquiring the insurance companies, or acquiring the pharmacies. I don't remember the order in which that happened. Yeah, but they used to not be tied in and vertically integrated. They used to be independent.
Thank you, Doug. Appreciate it. It's complicated stuff. I understand some of it. Thank you, sir. You did a good job. Walter Dub Lane, Associate Professor of Economics and Finance at my alma mater, UNO. It's Noel's alma mater as well. We'll find out what he's got planned for us when we come back on WWL.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
It's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And you're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of Browns.
You know
fans.
Why it's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos. Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.